So for those of you that don't know me, like he and Denny have said, my name is Jacob Miller. I'm one of the elders in training here, getting ready to be confirmed here next weekend. I'm not the guy that's usually up here, so if you're visiting today and I fly this thing straight into the ground, come back next week and give us another chance, I would encourage you to do that. But today we're going to talk about discipleship. This feels really loud, is it? Okay, all right. Today we're going to talk about discipleship. More up? Good? I'm a rookie with this stuff. I'm like not a technology guy whatsoever. I don't even use like anything but paper. It's ridiculous. Okay. So today we're going to talk about discipleship, and we're going to talk about something that is near and dear to my heart, which is generational discipleship. And it's not something that is really discussed a lot in the church, and not something that is practiced a lot in the church. And when I say the church, I'm talking about the church, the big church. We could say the American church, in the very least, if not beyond that. And I was going to be honest with you and tell you that I had a sermon completely worked out. I mean, I had worked on it for several days, weeks, had it all written out, was all ready to go on this subject of discipleship, had my plan to go through the Great Commission and Deuteronomy 6 and all these different verses and stuff, and I never had peace with it. I really, really struggled with it. And so yesterday morning, I scrapped the entire thing. And I don't usually do that. It's not a good idea to do that. But I really felt like the problem with it was too content-driven, and I was trying to explain something that I have a passionate heart for, in generational discipleship through content rather than through testimony. And so I'm going to be blending my testimony in a sense of where I came from, where Laura and I have came from in generational discipleship and why we feel so strongly about it, and just blend some scripture in with that. So that's kind of what we're going to be doing here. I'm going to be trying to share my heart for this with you as a future elder for the church. So a little bit about me in the realm of testimony, just to get it started. When I was younger, I grew up in the church. Both my mother and both of my grandmothers were strong in the faith. So I kind of had a little country Southern Baptist church on my mom's side and a little country Southern Baptist church on my dad's side. And I was usually at one of those two places growing up. The women regularly took me there. So I grew up, vacation Bible school, Sunday school. When I got older, I would sit out and I would listen to the preacher preach and go to youth ministry group-driven things. And being in a Baptist church, they taught me the Bible. I mean, they did. That's the strength of theirs. They do that. And so I knew the information really well. And I could recite it to you. I mean, I knew it well enough that I could talk it back to you. But it never really took root in me. And I wasn't really connected to that truth. It was like truth as facts. It was just true. It was just things that I knew. So consequently, as I got into my teenage years, whenever I started facing more adult versions of sin and temptation, and then also living in a world that was telling me that God didn't even exist, I just walked away. I did what a lot of young people do. I just walked away. It was very easy to do because I didn't really have relational roots in that church with individuals. I was just in group settings, and so walking away was easy. I did it quietly, and there's never really an issue. Never really even came up again after that. But that part of my that era of my life, and when I think about where the church was at there, that was the era of basically like the super pastor. That was the guy that preached the word, and like the whole church, in a sense, kind of revolved around him and his leadership. So that was kind of my experience. And they were good guys, right? They were good guys. All he's missing is, it looks good on him, right? All he's missing is the hot pink tiger stripe cup to drink water out of. But that was my experience growing up. Everything really revolved around that one man, in my opinion. I mean, I could be wrong, but that's kind of what I remember. And they were good people. I'm still close to one of the pastors that I grew up with. Great, great, super great guy. But that was kind of the way the church was structured. And so that was just my experience with it. And if you wanted to be a pastor, you had to go to seminary. If you didn't go to seminary, you couldn't be a pastor. You could barely lead, really. But you for sure had to go to seminary if you wanted to be a pastor. And if you wanted to be like an on-fire Christian, then you had to go to the mission field. And so growing up, I remember kind of, I didn't really know where my place was. I didn't really know where I fit either. I didn't know what my role was in the church. So when I walked away, I spent almost a decade really just walking in the flesh and making decisions in the flesh that lead to death, because that's where the flesh leads you. It leads to death. And for about a decade, I really had a huge lack of direction, huge complete lack of understanding about so many things in life, which is something that I find characterizes this group, this generation of young men as well. Lack of understanding, lack of direction is a plague on our young men. But that was definitely my experience of it. I didn't know why I was here. I didn't know where I was going. I didn't know who I was. And those are some pretty foundational questions to not really know the answers to. So I really lived those years and just completely wasted my life. Have you guys ever entered a season of life where you one day doesn't really look any different than the next, and one week doesn't look any different than the next, and then a week doesn't look any different than the month doesn't look any different than a year, and before you know it, you blink, and you're like, where did the last 5 years of my life go? There's really no sense of risk, adventure, nothing new, no growth, no nothing, just the same. Everything's the same, and it just kind of turns into like sitting on a train and just watching it all go by really, really fast. Now, there were a few strong catalysts that really took me out of that season of life, but there was none that was more profound or more powerful for me than becoming a father. Because if any of you know me or know my story, you know that to say that I was not close to my father growing up is an understatement. And so I had a lot of personal baggage about fatherhood. A lot of things that whenever I was younger, I would say, you know, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to be that. I'm not going to do this. There was a lot of those kind of ideas. Even though I've had those super strong convictions, though, that I wouldn't do and I wouldn't be and I wouldn't do and I wouldn't be, I found that in spite of all my good intentions, I was doing and being those things that I always said I would never do. And I was powerless to stop it. I had no real ability to not be that person, I found. Can anybody identify with that? Do you ever wonder sometimes why everything that you're doing, in spite of all your hopes and dreams and desires, it's not working? It's because you can't choose life without Christ. It's not even possible. You can't do it. And that's where I was. In spite of all my good intentions, I was failing, and it was totally unacceptable to me. But like I said, I was powerless to stop it. So it led me to a place, though, because my current faith at the time was atheism. I did not believe in God. But I found that took faith as well. I was like, okay, where does that lead me? Because this is not really working either. And so I got to a place where I was really just kind of tired of faith in general. I wanted something to make sense. That's really what I wanted. And so I kind of started pursuing whatever, anything, in an effort. I started pursuing evidence and arguments and things like this because I wanted to know what made sense. I wanted something that stood up to the tests of reason and to the weight of life, because my belief system wasn't holding up to the weight of life. It was being crushed under it. And that journey led me to Christ and back to his church. And I, you know, started doing things like getting involved with the church, getting back into his word. I actually went back to college at that point in my mid-20s, in my fourth attempt by then, and got my degree in religion because I just wanted to study something I wanted to know more about. Finished my degree on attempt 4. Some of us take a few times to get it right. But I started encountering the word, and I started encountering passages that really, really just impacted me. And one of them was Ezekiel 22:30, where God is rebuking Judah and Jerusalem specifically. And he's telling the people there, he said, I looked for a man among you who would build up the wall and stand in the gap before me so that I would not have to destroy the land and the people. But I didn't find anyone. There was no one there. I found no one. I looked for someone to stand in the gap, but there was no one. And that really impacted me because I knew that was true in my life, and I saw it so often in other people's lives. And as I was going through that time in the church, I was visiting churches, attending churches, being a member at churches, but I really felt like I looked at the men, and they were really still largely unengaged, in my opinion. And my engagement really still centered largely around being a father. I didn't want to fail Ethan, my oldest son, my only son at the time. I knew that my father had really, in fairness to him, he had been handed bondage growing up. And I had been handed bondage growing up. And I knew that I did not want to hand that to Ethan. I wanted to give him a taste of freedom. I wanted him to taste it and see what it looked like. And then offer him, for him to choose it. Ultimately, he has to choose it himself. I knew that, but that's what I wanted for him. And I knew I had to stand in the gap for him. And I had to get it done. And now that I was in Christ and in the church, I found that started happening. Things started changing. I didn't realize it at the time. It took several years. But during that time, even though in the day-to-day I was largely on my own, God was fathering me. God was becoming my father. And he was discipling me. He was teaching me. And he was refining me through the fire and just making me a new man during that time. At the same time, as a police officer, I was working the street. And I was out. And I was seeing families in crisis every day. And it's just, that's like part of the job. People call 911 when things go wrong, not whenever everything's hunky-dory, right? It's whenever things are bad. So I would encounter this lostness every day, and the weight of it, and the weight of these men that I saw in all these generations from old to young, and seeing them being lost in the gap, not standing in the gap, but being lost in it. And the weight of that really started impacting me, especially whenever I would see it in young men. It really affected me because I identified with that as a young man, having gone through those times, and now as a father, knowing that someday my son was going to be in that age group. It really impacted me. So I want to illustrate this point with a story, and we're going to take this young man and we're going to look at his life at different stages here. This is a personal story. It's a true story. And this is fairly typical of the kind of things that you encounter whenever you're working the street. I got a call for service, and I went to a lady's house. She called in, and she said, on the call comments, it was, my 16-year-old son has just assaulted me. I need the police. And so I showed up. It was a little old house over here in the north side of town. Mom was there by herself. Dad was not in the picture. She had a 16-year-old son that was a pretty good-sized kid, very angry, probably because he's never met his father. So he has kind of a reason to be. But because he was getting to be, you know, like feeling like he was a man, he was starting to become physical with his anger, even toward his mother. And he had punched her in the face and called her all kinds of names and all this kind of stuff. And she was bawling. And so I'm down there. He's 16 years old, so he's a juvenile. So mom is his authority. And I said, what do you want us to do? And she said, I don't know what to do. She said, I don't know where to take him. I don't have any place. And unfortunately, this is my personal thing. I've seen it a lot. I'm not a huge fan of it. Your options are things like Burrell Behavioral Health, Cox North, Mercy, psych units, drugs, psychiatry. Those are basically your options. And so I asked her, I was like, do you want him to stay here? And I refer this as juvenile, because juvenile won't take kids either unless they've killed somebody, pretty much nowadays. You know, I can refer it to juvenile, or do you want him to go somewhere? She's like, well, I want him to go to Burrell. That's what we fought about, but he refused to go, and that's what we got into this fight about when he hit me. I want him to go to Burrell. I said, well, how many times has he been to Burrell? Well, about 8. Is it working? No. But I don't have anywhere else to put him. So I was like, okay, to Burrell we go then. She's like, well, he's not going to go. And I said, well, he's going to go one way or the other. That's kind of how this works. I mean, if I can't do it, then I got 350 people that I can, you know, we're going to get this done one way or the other. That's just how this works. He can't not go if you say he goes. And so I start walking up the stairs in this house towards this kid's bedroom. And she starts, I don't know if she was worried about me or she's worried about him, I don't know. But she started saying things like, his psychiatrist is saying that he has oppositional defiance disorder, and he has, and he's bipolar, and he is incapable of making the right choices. It's not his fault. He's incapable, he can't do it, he can't make the right choices. So I was like, well, okay. And so I continue walking up the stairs, and as I hit the hallway, I heard her yell up. She said, he's ripped the door off of its hinges, and so the door's not connected. It's just leaning up against the front of it. But if you knock on the door, he'll probably answer it. And I thought, I'm not knocking on the door. But I was like, okay. So I just kept walking, and I didn't skip a beat whenever I hit the room. I just walked straight into the door, grabbed it, walked into the room, and sat it down. And this kid was standing there. He had a bathroom off of his room, and the shower was on. He was standing there in a pair of athletic shorts, and he was looking out from that doorway, and I was standing here holding this door, and his eyes just got that big. And I said, "Hey, I need you to come over here and sit down for me." And he said, "Well, I was getting ready to take a shower." And I was like, "Not anymore. Now you're going to come over and sit down so we can talk. First right choice." He just walked over and sat down. And so I started talking to him about what happened and talking to him about his mom. And I explained to him, I said, "Here's the thing. I know you don't want to go to Burl. I understand why you don't want to go to Burl, but you don't have any other options. You're going to go to Burl. You don't have a choice in the matter. You will go. Do you understand that?" "Yes, I do." Second right choice. All of a sudden, he's capable of making the right choices. And so I started talking to him about, because at that time in my life, I didn't really like my job a whole lot anyways, and I'm still kind of there. I thought, well, if they fire me for being a Christian, then so be it. That's God's problem, not mine. So I would talk to people about Christ. And so I talked to him about that. I talked to him about being a real man. I talked to him about how he needed to be the kind of man for other people that he wanted, for himself, but he didn't have. And that he needed to find the right people to help him, teach him to be that way. And he told me he understood. We had a good conversation. And then I asked him, I was like, "Hey, do you want a shirt and a pair of, shoes or something?" He's like, "Yep." So I went and got it, put them on. We went down, walked to the car, hunky-dory, no problems. That was one of my experiences with him. Because with people in those situations, and with young men especially, in my experience with it, what they need, what they don't often have, is a father figure or an elder man to give them some boundaries and some direction. That's really what they need, and they respond to it every time. They don't always respond that easily, but they respond to it. Well, all the things that she had tried and all the things that she had done, just an elder man who he could push against, that was sturdy enough to hold up in more ways than one, not just physically or anything like that, but just that made sense. That's what he needed. And that's been my experience with those kind of things. So I began to understand, as I encountered these things over and over again, families in crisis, families in crisis, families in crisis, I realized that we had lost two very powerful tools of redemption in our culture. We've lost the power of fatherhood and motherhood in our culture, and in so doing, have lost the power of the family. And those are two very, very powerful tools for redemption to lose. And we are losing them and have, in a sense, lost them. So we're going to hit a couple of scriptures. We're going to talk about marriage a little bit, and we're going to talk about family as it relates to our faith. We're going to spend just a few brief minutes in Genesis chapter 2. Verse 15, and I'm not going to go through the whole thing, but I'll summarize the parts that come after this. But we know that God created Adam, and he put him in the garden. He put him in the garden, and in verse 15 it says, "The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and to keep it." That's translated to cultivate and to keep, and a few other different ways, but I tend to stick to the verbology, or the phraseology, I guess I should say, of cultivate and keep. Now, we know that he went on, and from that point, he had created Adam, he had put him in the garden, he had given him that mandate, and he said, "Adam, you are reflecting my image. We're going to make this man in our image, the Trinity." And what that, in a basic sense, what that really means is that we are set apart from the animals. We're not the animals, right? We're set apart from them. We have, being created in his image, we have the ability to think, to reason, to create, to love, right? We have these abilities to exhibit character. And so these are the things that make us like God, to have emotions, right? Things that animals don't have. And as his crown, the crown of his creation, that is how we were made to reflect his image. Now, so he created Adam in his image. He set him in the garden. He said, "Cultivate and keep this garden." And then he said, "It's not good for man to be alone. I'm going to make him a helpmeet." And from Adam, he withdrew Eve. And so they together in marriage, in the first union there in the garden, they together now reflected God's glory in a way together now that Adam used to do on his own. And God, we know that God created us equal in worth, but complementary in function, right? We know that there are some things that women are just better at than men are. Go to my house, you'll see lots of them. So there are some things that women are better at than men. There are some things that men are better at than women, right? We're made to complement each other. There's some things that we need that are different, right? And we know that we're encouraged, Paul encourages the men to love their wives and the women to respect their husbands, right? Because a man wants to be respected. He wants to be loved too, but he wants to be respected a little bit more. There's a little more rhythm of his heart in being respected. Just like a woman, she wants to be loved. That's the rhythm of her heart. She wants to be loved well. She wants to be loved unconditionally. But she also wants to be respected, right? It's not that it's not one or the other. It's just one is a little more of the rhythm of that heart. You can look at other examples. Women have the ability to think emotionally, even over logical thinking. Men tend to be more logical, logic only, right? This is why we can completely miss things that are very important when it comes to people. My wife does that to me all the time. She'll be like, what do you think about this? And I'll be like, 1 + 1 = 2. She'll be like, whoa, I wasn't even talking math. I was talking like the important things, like the heart of these people, right? Oh, yes, that's important too, right? That's not my strength. But she does that for me. We do that together, right? That's where we're made to complement each other. So I have my own theory. It's not a scientific theory, but I have my own theory about cultivating and keeping. Adam was made in God's image, and he was given the mandate, cultivate and keep. Then God withdrew Eve from Adam, and I think that I would argue that's another thing that is also complementary in nature. That keeping or watching or defending or protecting is the rhythm of a man's heart. And that cultivating or nurturing or growth is the rhythm of a woman's heart. They're equally as important as each other. One is just as important as the other. However, I would argue that until things are being defended, kept, watched over, growth can occur. And I'll explain that to you. A good friend of mine who taught me this, who's actually sitting in the room today, he told me one time, he said, your job as a man is to create security, because security creates stability, and stability creates safety. And with safety comes growth. And until safety occurs, growth can't occur. If you've ever been into gardening or growing anything, you know this is true, right? You can't just put something anywhere you want. You put it where you can take care of it. You put it where you can keep the pests and the animals off of it. And all. If you don't do these things, or it gets enough sunshine, but not too much, enough water, but not too much, right? Until it's safe, it won't grow. And Anthony, that young man, that was his first name, I remember it to this day, he was not in a safe environment, and he probably had almost never been in one. And so his growth was affected. I know that that was true for myself as a young man. I wasn't close to my father, but the women in my family, they cultivated and they created the safety for me that they could. They gave me unconditional love, and it was on that foundation that God built whenever it was time to make me into a man, because I was into my 20s and I wasn't one yet. But it was because of what they did for me that I even had a place to start. So that's marriage. That's man and woman. And that is what is important, I think, or the rhythm of who we are, men as keepers. I think it's just evident in our culture, right? If we had a football here and we divided these chairs up and we choose even teams on the guys, right? And we said, hey, half of us are going to carry this ball to the other side, the other half are going to stop us. Somebody's going to the hospital, right? It's just how we're made. That's why we invest so much time in fantasy sports and living vicariously through video games and all this kind of stuff that speaks to our heart so well. I think it's because it's how we're made. Now, let's look at the family a little bit. Let's look at the family a little bit. Let's go to Deuteronomy 4. We're going to be in 4, verse 9. Now, in this section of Deuteronomy, Moses is the leader of Israel, and he's coming. His time as a leader is coming to a close. And so these are kind of, we're getting into the realm of Moses' last words. If you know anything about Moses, you know, in that culture, he's kind of a big deal. He's a very big deal. He's like, he's the one of the few guys that can pull a Napoleon Dynamite. He's like, I'm kind of a big deal. That's Moses, right? He's the man, right? And so, but he's on his way out. God's like, you're not going to get to go into the promised land because of all these things. The people have been disobedient, et cetera, et cetera. So Moses is preparing them for his departure. And so we're going to read through this a little bit. But he's trying to encourage them to honor God so that he will bless them as they go into the land. That's what he wants for them. That's what he wanted whenever they were supposed to go there the first time, in the first place. So he's trying to encourage them and teach them how they can do that. So he starts off leading up into 4:9. He's warning them against worshiping false idols. And he's commanding them to obedience, to be obedient to the Lord. And I'll pick it up and read here in verse 9. Only take care and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things that your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life. Make them known to your children and your children's children. How on the day that you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, the Lord said to me, gather the people to me, that I may let them hear my words, so that they may learn to fear me all the days that they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children to do so. Now, he continues on, and we'll skip ahead a little bit into chapter 5. And he goes into the Ten Commandments. So he says, what does he say to them leading up to this? He says, you have to teach this to your children. That's really the point that he made. It's not just enough that you follow me, that you love him, that you follow him, that you love him, that you obey him. You have to teach your children to do so. And so after he encourages them to do that, he goes on into chapter 5, verse 16. And we are well into the Ten Commandments. Now, when we think the Ten Commandments, what do we think of? Like, what really comes to mind? If you ever read or you grew up where King James was used, it was thou shalt not, right? Thou shalt not do this. Thou shalt not do this. Thou shalt not do this. But there is a positive commandment in there. There is a thou shalt. Does anybody know what it is? Honor your father and your mother. The rest of them are don't do this. There is one that is a do this. It's chapter 5, verse 16. Honor, that is, have a reverence and respect for your father and your mother. As the Lord your God commanded you, that your days may be long and that it may go well with you in the land that the Lord your God has given you. This also is unique in this commandment, that it is the only commandment, as Paul says later on in Ephesians. He says, this is the commandment with a promise. And so what Moses is teaching them and what God relayed through the Ten Commandments, he says, if you honor me and you teach your children to honor you, then someday your children will honor me. That's what he's saying. It's a commandment with a promise. If you do this, this is what you will get. And so Moses is trying to teach them this principle as they move into the promised land. We're going to move on to chapter 6. Moses goes back to the same idea, and he hits it again. The same idea of how you translate the faith to the next generation. He says, chapter 6, verse 1, now this is the commandment, the statutes and the rules that the Lord your God commanded me to teach you, that you may do them in the land to which you are going over to possess it, and that you may fear the Lord your God, you and your son's son, by keeping all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you, all the days of your life, and that your days may be long. Hear therefore, O Israel, be careful to do them that it may go well with you, and that you may multiply greatly as the Lord your God, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. So here he hits it again. Pay attention to what I'm saying. You have to teach these things to your children. Now, we're going to move on. Basically, he reiterates that command in verses 1 through 3 there. He says the family is how you transmit your faith. It's how you translate your faith to the next generation, the family. It's not Moses. Moses didn't say it's me. He knew Joshua was going to succeed him. He didn't say it was Joshua. He didn't say they had lots of judges that they had set over the people at that point in time because they'd become too many for Moses to be able to handle. Didn't say it was the judge's job. It was the family's job to teach their children. It's the same thing for us. It's not Super JT's job to raise your children to honor God. It's not mine or Cornelius or Denny's as future elders' responsibility to teach your children to honor God. It's yours. And it's something we have to take seriously. It's something we have to be intentional about. Because if you don't, we'll get caught in that same American trap of providing for our kids materially and starving them spiritually. And just hoping that if we bring them to the right place by association somehow, they'll get it. I think that's what we do a lot of the time. So now, Moses, Moses is coming up here. Moses is coming up here, and he's given it to him a couple of times. Teach your children, teach your children, teach your children. And so that now he gives them, in verse 4 through 9, he gives them kind of an idea of what it looks like. What does it look like to teach your children? He illustrates it for them. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. And I know that especially as you go on into that verse, it's easy to be lost in the cultural difference between us and them. So I wrote, this is a Jakeism, it's not scripture, but I wrote this a little differently. So just hear this. This, I think, is kind of the heart of what he's saying. Love God with all that you are and all that you have. Teach your children from the overflow of that heart. Teach these things to your children diligently as you live with them, no matter where you are or where you are going. Meditate on these truths by keeping them before you, whether you are still or whether you are going. Surround yourself with them so that you may ever be reminded of them. I think that would be a cultural translation for us. But there's one more thing that is bound up in this example that he's given us. He's saying family transmits faith. That's what Moses is saying over and over again. But you know, there's another element, and he goes into it later, and actually 11 times in Deuteronomy, God says this through Moses. Not only do you teach your children, but within the context of family, you're also to teach and to minister to orphans, widows, and the outcast, people who don't have family. So 11 times in Deuteronomy alone, and you know he says it a lot in the Old Testament overall, but 11 times in Deuteronomy alone, he says the orphan, the widow, and the outcast. If these people don't have family, you are to bring them into your family. So we see again that it's the family that God created that he wants us to transfer our love for him through. He desires that heart of obedience to come from a mother and a father to a son and a daughter. Let me take this back to my example of young Anthony's life. Does he have a biological father? He does. Has he ever met him? No. Is that fairly common? Unfortunately, it is. He has a biological father. Let me ask you this one. Is his relationship with his mother healthy? Does it support growth? You're answering it from limited knowledge. From my limited knowledge, I would say no. Mom was a complete mess. She was a wreck. So what are his options? Drugs, the legal kind and the illegal kind, but he was on legal ones that I knew of for sure anyways. Counseling. He even has the option of youth ministries. That's kind of what I encourage him to do, right? You need to find people. I told him you need to find an elder man that can pour into your life. And you need to find friends that empower you to help you make the right decisions that lead you to Christ, that leads you to life. We're talking about a whole different life here. I think youth ministries, in the realm of ministry, though they have their pros and their cons, it's the way we do it in America, youth ministry. It's just the way it's done. It's went through some changes over the years, but by and large, and we all have an idea what that means. Some pros of youth ministry would be, at least in this area, a lot of times they're getting the Bible preached to them in some manner, in some way, for some length of time. Sometimes it's only 10 minutes, and they spend 50 minutes playing dodgeball. But they do get it. And sometimes they get more. Sometimes they get more than that. Another pro would be Christian friends. What parent doesn't want the young people that their children are running around with to be at least kids who desire to follow Christ? Sure, that's a good thing. I want that for my children. It's not a bad thing. But there are some cons to it as well. It's a group-driven ministry. It's a large group-driven ministry, let me say. Very easy to disappear from, very easy to not connect with, in my opinion and in my experience, generally speaking. Another con is I think that we are teaching our children that church is all about them because they have a special one. They have youth church. And then whenever they get older, they become adults, they find out the world does not revolve around them. And they don't know how to act. Does anybody here have any idea what the statistical rate of retention is for high school students as they go into college from the church? High school students that are in the church, when they go to college, how many of them do we keep? Does anybody want to throw out a number? Any brave soul? Denny is the man. 20%, roughly. Statistics or studies that you'll read put it under 20%. But roughly 20%, we have about a 20% retention rate for youth ministries from high school to college. That's unacceptable. So I think in the realm of options for him, there are definitely some pros in that, but I think there are some cons as well. He doesn't have a lot of good options. Is he an orphan? Is Anthony an orphan? What do you think? Well, he has a mother, so technically no. But he doesn't have a father, so he's probably half and half on being technically an orphan, right? Is he spiritually an orphan? Yes, he is. 100% on that one, no 50-50. Spiritually, he is an orphan. Now, just speaking from my experience again as well, in the church, growing up, we had the super pastor. We had expositional preaching from the word. That was good, but it was really centered around that and maybe teaching you the Bible, but not teaching you how to get from the Bible yourself, how to apply that in your life. Now we have begun to address those things in the church. And again, this is kind of from my perspective. We've addressed those things, some of the weaknesses of that model with small group ministry. Now we have created a small group of brothers and sisters, and they work through the word, and they work through applying that word together in that small group of brothers and sisters. It's kind of a mutual discipleship situation, and it's a move away from truth as fact or as just truth as statement, right? I know these facts, I know these things. It's a movement away from just truth as facts and making it into truth as relational. That's what Jesus did by even coming here, right? It wasn't just believe in these things, it was believe in me and watch my life. So it's a movement towards that, towards a relational relationship with truth and an insight in my own life. It's a good thing. It's family. It's taking the church family and making it smaller and more intimate and living an actual brotherhood and sisterhood with other people in the church. It's a great thing. It's a great idea. Now I would argue, though, that we need to make the family complete. We need to resurrect and redeem the role of father and mother in biological families and in spiritual families. We need to focus as parents. We, the leaders, need to focus on the parents of our church as the means by which to transmit the faith to their children. And to their spiritual children, to their physical children, and to their spiritual children. Jesus himself, after all, he redefined the family whenever he came, if you think about it. Think about the time in Matthew where he was sitting, he was teaching, it was crowded, his mother and his brothers are trying to get to him to kind of say, like, dude, you've lost it. You need to come back home, right? Because at that point, they didn't really believe in him. And they couldn't get there, so they sent somebody to give him a message and say, hey, your mother and your brothers are outside, and they want to talk to you. And what was his response? My mother and my brothers and my sisters are right here. These people are my mother and my brothers and my sisters. Now, he wasn't forsaking his family, but he was expanding it. We know he wasn't forsaking his family because he continued in his life with his family. Two of his brothers became pillars of the church. His mother, when he was on the cross, he asked John to watch after her. He didn't forsake his family. He said, he didn't say those people are no longer my family, but he expanded the notion of it. He said, this is now my family, my spiritual family. It supersedes just biology. Although certainly biology is important because our children are our children and they are our responsibility. Now, I also think that we see this pattern in Jesus' ministry, right? He spoke to the masses. He spoke to the large group, right? Think Sermon on the Mount or the feeding of the 5,000, right? That was after he spoke. So he spoke truth, expositional preaching like we've had in the past and like we have now still today. We still do that. That's a good thing. He had the disciples. He had 12 men whom he was more intimate and close with that he lived with as brothers, and he taught them through life in that relationship. But then even within that, he had the three, Peter, James, and John. And that was an even more intimate and even a more experiential relationship with them. He allowed those three, he showed things to those three, and he allowed them access to things he didn't allow for the other 12. He even took it a step further with them as individuals. And that's kind of what I'm talking about today. Taking it one step further to generational discipleship, including that in how we disciple. We have expositional preaching. We have small groups of brothers and sisters. It's time to reinstitute and to resurrect the mother and the father in our church. This, I believe, is reflected in the New Testament church. You see this in the New Testament church. Peter in 1 Peter, in that letter, he calls Silvanus his brother, but he also calls Mark his son. He makes a difference. He differentiates those two things. Paul does this a lot. Paul, in speaking about Titus and Timothy in Titus and 1 and 2 Timothy, he calls them, he uses the words true child or beloved child and talking about them. But then in the same letters, he talks about people like his sister Phoebe and other brothers in the faith. So they made a difference. They differentiated the difference between sons and daughters and mothers and brothers. In Titus, Paul specifically instructs the elder generation of men to teach the younger generation of men and the elder generation of women to teach the younger generation of men, women. So we see these elements of mutual discipleship of brothers and sisters, living together as brothers and sisters, but we also see this element of fatherhood and motherhood in the church, in the New Testament church. So as we consider generational discipleship, which is what we are really pushing and working towards building in our small group, or in our small groups, in our men's and women's discipleship time here in the church, what does that mean for us? Like if I were going to give it a simple definition, what does it look like? It looks like this. It's one older person walking one younger person through the challenges of life and faith. It's not complicated. You're just walking with them. You're just there with them. As you rise and as you lay down, as you walk and as you sit, as you go and as you come. It's just life with the younger generation. This costs you. This maximizes your influence on somebody because it maximizes your time with them and your intentionality with them, but it costs you. I've done it for years. It's cost my pocketbook. It has cost my emotions, you know, emotional capital, because it's like having kids. Half the time they don't listen, right? And you're like, I've done this before. You're heading over the cliff. And you just have to let them drive, right? Because sometimes that's how we learn. That's how I learned the hard way. I'm very stubborn. But it's as we get into this, I'm telling you it's going to cost you. It's going to cost you to disciple your children, to do more than just bring them to church on Sunday. It's going to cost you turning off the television, even when you're tired and you just want to sit there and veg out. It's going to cost you your pride or your ability to succumb to your fears of even thinking you know how to do this, to open up your Bible, to teach your children. It's sad, but I think it's very safe to say it's not the norm for fathers to do this and for mothers to do this. But it should be. It's the way that we were designed to work. It is the design. If I were to ask you right now for a show of hands, how many of you would like to have somebody, and some of you already do have here, but how many of you would like to have somebody in your life right now who is an elder generation to you that could help you walk through life, navigate your life and your faith? Is there anybody who would say no to that? I've never. Yeah, you can really do it. I mean, you know what? That's been my experience with it. We did this, Laura and I did this, and we were at Life Point with the college ministry. We really tried to push this, and we were still learning our way through it too, but I never, ever, 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 ever met someone who said, nope, I'm good. But you know what happened to me whenever I asked, as the college ministry grew, and we went to people in the church, and we said, hey, would you be willing to disciple a college student? You know what I got? About 99% of the time, actually every time, and Laura got it too from the women. I don't care if they've been in church for 30 years. I don't know how to do that. I don't know what to do. I'd love to. Don't know how. Sorry. And we had some people be like, I don't know how to do that, but I guess I'll give it a shot. I'm like, that's what I'm looking for. That's what I'm looking for, right? But isn't it strange that the one thing that Jesus told us to do, by and large in the church in America, we have no idea how to do it. We just hope that people like Super JT do it for us. Really, that's what we do. We hope we like learn by osmosis. Have you guys ever seen that Garfield little thing, you know, where he has these books on top of his head? And like, what are you doing? He's like, I'm learning by osmosis. We hope that happens like that somehow. Some of you don't even know what Garfield is, I know. But let me ask you this. Can you do that? Could you do that as a church? Could you honestly communicate and intentionally walk through life with somebody who's younger than you? Do you think you could do that? I know you can. If we can do that, I think we will recapture a powerful force of redemption for our culture. Now, I want to preempt some thoughts that you have. I know you have them, right? Like we just talked about there, that the first thing that I usually hear is, I don't know how to do that. And I'm going to relay some more wisdom from Master Ku that I told you. I told you a story about him last time we were together. And in all seriousness, this is probably one of the more, if not most, important lessons he ever taught me, my martial arts instructor from back in the day when I was obsessed with all that stuff. He was not a big fan of American martial arts. This was back when, like, MMA was just starting. So a lot of things that we did here were really point fighting based and stuff. He had no respect for it. So he didn't have a lot of respect for American martial arts. And he would say, oh, you give black belt, he spoke in broken English, this is my Master Ku impression. He would say, oh, you give black belt 2 years America, 2 years, 10 years Korea, 10 years Korea, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so one day I'd have been with him about 8 years, and I was sitting there because I kind of lived there whenever I wasn't working or whatever and stuff. And I was sitting there and I was just talking with him, and he walked out, no pomp and circumstance, no testing, no forms, no nothing. And he threw a black belt at me. He said, here, you can teach. And I said, whoa. I didn't accept it gracefully because I was going to be the third person in America he'd ever given one to, in all seriousness. But I took it and I threw it back at him. I was a stubborn son. I was like, uh-uh. I was like, you give me that whenever I earn it, not just because you want somebody to help you teach. And he just laughed at me, just big belly laugh, you know, just laughed at me. He said, you think you know? Basically, he was saying, you think you know everything? You think I'm saying that you know everything because I'm giving you a black belt? He said, no, no, no. You teach, you learn. And he was right. Because my growth from that moment on probably doubled. He took everything I knew about martial arts and he wadded it up into a little ball and he shook it and then he turned it completely upside down. And everything that I saw about it looked differently to me from that point on. You teach, you learn. Don't be afraid to teach. It doesn't mean you know everything. It doesn't mean you even need to know everything. It just means that you're in a different season of life than somebody else has. You've already lived that. You've already made mistakes through it. You've learned from that. You've applied the word to it. That's called wisdom. You have it, whether you realize it or not. Don't sell yourself short. The second thing is, for those of you who are not mothers and fathers right now, I know that in your mind, you're like, I'm not a father. how could I be a father to somebody younger than me, right? Well, first of all, you will be in a discipleship chain with somebody who is, maybe more than one person who is. They can teach you what it's like to be in that role. The second thing is, where do you think the best place is to learn that? After you become a biological father and you're scrambling around trying to figure out what it means? No, that's not the best place to learn that. The best place to learn it is before you ever need it, okay? Ethan is now 13 years old. I have a teenager. I had teenagers before I ever had a teenager. That's why I don't have any hair. I told Laura several times, we'd be talking about these young men I was discipling. I would say, you know what? This is what it's going to be like to have a teenager. This is what it's going to be like. I have some experience with it, even though I'm just now getting there, right? It's no different. Now, being a father figure or a mother figure doesn't mean you have to legally adopt someone. It doesn't mean you're agreeing to take on their student loan debt or their college tuition, right? I'm not saying that. It just means that you're willing to stand up and intentionally create security, stability, and safety in their lives so that you can empower them toward meaningful growth. You're doing that individually, purposefully, and intentionally in their life. You want them to have meaningful growth so they can have the blessings that follow, the life that follows that meaningful growth. Now, through our group discipleship time, with men's and women's discipleship, our entire goal is to empower you to be able to do this. That's really what we are about. We don't have all the answers, but we've got some answers, and we're pushing ahead, and we're figuring this out as we go. Because I tell you what, this isn't done. There's nobody that I know of that I can ask how they've done this as a church. Now, in churches, a lot of times, you'll find a few people who do this instinctively on their own. I've never known someone who's built a ministry around it. Never heard of it. But we believe that it's important, and we're willing to give it a shot. We're willing to do this. So we are going to do everything we can to support you. We're going to do everything we can to be Moses and Joshua and the judges as your leaders to help empower you to disciple your children, your physical children, and your spiritual children. Because God knows there is a ton of spiritual children out there that need father and mother figures. In these times, we don't concentrate specifically on just feeding you the word, but we're going to try to teach you how to get through it yourself. I didn't understand how to read the Bible until I took a class in college called Inductive Bible Study. 28 years reading the Bible. Nobody had ever taught me these things. Ever. I really, going to the Bible, I would really pretty much feel like I didn't know where to go and how to get it, how to get what I needed. I took this class. It was pretty simple. I called up my pastor and I was like, man, this really ticks me off. I grew up in church. Nobody ever taught me how to do this. But now I feel like I can go anywhere to the Bible and get it, understand it. We need to be teaching things like that. Now, I believe that we can create chains of discipleship that span from one elder man to two younger men to 4 to 8 to 16 to 32, from grandfather down to junior high student. But we have to be in it to win it. These are long-term ministries. You're talking about life on life. It's a long-term commitment. But this is ministry that is multiplication. I've told my guys before in men's discipleship, if we started with 10 guys who discipled a guy or two guys a year, and we grew every year, but just by them taking on a new one every year, every year we multiplied that, and that guy taking on a new one. We started with 10, and 10 years we couldn't fit in JQH. And every year after that, it doubles. If you noticed, the early church experienced multiplicative growth like this. They grew by multiplication, not by people who are fishing for a different church. They grew by multiplication, by making disciples. Nowadays, in places like China, where they don't get the opportunity to meet like this, this is how they grow. And you know what? The Chinese government has a problem on their hands because they're going to be outnumbered before too long. That's truth. Even though Chairman Mao burned every Bible in the country and said we successfully eradicated the Christian God from this land, he was wrong. Lots of people have tried it. They've never accomplished it. Let's apply this idea to Anthony's life and we'll be done. What if Anthony had been brought in to a church whenever he was in elementary school and was taught the word when he was young? What if as he entered junior high, like a high school age or a young college age guy, took him under his wing and taught him, gave him his first taste of generational discipleship, helped walk him through middle school, even though it's not cool to do so, but helped walk him through life like that. And what if sometimes Anthony would be with his high school age guy, but he would also get the opportunity to be around college age guys that were pouring into the high school guys? And what if on other occasions, he would get the opportunity to be with those two sets of guys, but then he would also get the opportunity to be around a young man who was married, maybe in his 20s, who was walking through marriage, maybe had children of his own? And what if he had the opportunity to be around this and see this? What if he got to see marriage and family, a healthy version of it, and he saw it with his own two eyes? Not perfect, not a perfect marriage and a perfect family, but a family that is built on love. What if he saw a man that loved and led the physical and the spiritual children that he had underneath his sphere of influence really well? What if he saw him love and lead those people really well? And he saw that those people adored and admired and followed that man. Do you think that he would be motivated to become that man? I think more so than anything I could ever say to him in a conversation. There's no equivalent for seeing it, for experiencing it. We have experiential truth cornered, folks. We don't just believe in things. We don't just believe in facts. We believe in a person who is the truth and who demonstrated that through life and experience. That's what we believe. Nobody else even claims to believe in that. We have to bring this discipleship in through small groups, this life-on-life brotherhood and sisterhood, through generational discipleship, this motherhood and fatherhood. That's what makes truth real when you apply it in life and relationship. That's what makes it real. So I believe we need to go past the realm of men's and women's ministry into the realm of brotherhood and sisterhood. Because as followers of the living God, and hear me on this, folks, we should be attempting the kind of things that only brotherhoods and sisterhoods can accomplish. We should be thinking big. If God is for us, who can be against us? But we need to be doing the kind of things that scare us a little bit. Let me ask you something, men. How many of you in your daily life have stopped to think, I need to pray for protection from the devil because I know that what I'm doing is catching some attention? We don't pray like that. You know why? Because deep down we know we're not a threat. I've thought that many times. I thought that about this, though. I think, man, to push generational discipleship, is that gonna raise some eyebrows? I think it is. It makes me think, man, maybe I need to be praying about this because I don't want my family to suffer hardship. I know God will be doing it to build us, to refine my character. And I know he always has my children in the palm of his hand, but I don't want to go through that unless I have to. It's just prompted me to even begin thinking things like that. And I thought, you know, before, I've never before prayed for protection because I know I haven't needed it. We should be attempting the kind of things that only in men's ministry and women's, that only would we even dare do it if we were together. Otherwise, we know we wouldn't try it. That's the way God created us, a diverse body of believers with different strengths and weaknesses that together accomplish making his kingdom real here so that people can experience that life. So God willing, in the next 5 to 10 years, if we do something like a men's discipleship father-son camping weekend, we would have 5 generations of men in one place. Not a college ministry and an older men's ministry and a youth ministry and a single adults ministry, but 5 generations of men in one place together, living life together, so the younger generation could see the older generation pouring in to them. And they would grow up with the understanding that that's how it works, that they would experience it. And they would see not just blood sons, but they would see spiritual sons. The spirit of adoption. We're all adopted in God's family. That would be a powerful force for the enemy to have to deal with. He's not going to like it. Doesn't mean we shouldn't shove it in his face. I'm going to close with this. I have discipled my son Ethan now since he was about 8, like formally sat down with him. Once every 2 weeks, which is what we ask people to do when they're discipling, I'll drive him to school and we'll stop and have breakfast together in the morning. And sometimes we just go through life together. I just catch up with him. I just communicate with him. But I always focus on open communication and vulnerability, being real, being authentic, and intentionality. This is your life. I want to move you from here to here. We're living life on purpose. Strong mind, strong body. That's what I tell him a lot, and I push him. I try to be intentional with him. But as he's gotten older now, it wasn't too long ago that he began to notice that other kids' fathers didn't do this. And so one time he told me, and it was very touching, he thanked me. He said, "You know what? I want to thank you for doing this. I know now this doesn't really happen very often." You know? And I was tempted to accept the credit briefly for it. But then I stopped myself and I said, "You know, son, I said, here's the thing. I appreciate your thankfulness." I said, "But if there's anything in me that you see that you like, that you admire, that you trust, that love that you experience, that selflessness, the intentionality, that's not me. That's Christ in me. I'm far too selfish to be this guy. I always was before. It wasn't until Christ was in me that this path started for you." And that's the truth. It doesn't matter how wrecked your life is. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that you have been trying and trying for so long and so long, and you're spinning your wheels and you can't get anywhere. You don't have the ability to get where you want to be. It doesn't matter. Christ can and will redeem that if you let him. You die to that. You die to that and you live a new life. And that's Christ in you. And then he will make you the kind of person whose influence has expanded exponentially. I'm about to become an elder next week. I have preached probably 9 times in my life. I would have laughed in your face if you told me I would be up preaching someday. That's what Christ does. He gives you a whole new life. And then from that life, he multiplies life to other people. And that's the truth of it. Let's pray together real quick. Lord, we love you. We thank you. We thank you so, so much for loving us enough to come to us to make truth not just a statement of facts, but a life to follow and a life to believe in. I pray that you would put generational discipleship in the hearts of the people here, that they would get out of their comfort zone and that they would follow you into intentional life with their children if they have them, with their biological children, but also with their spiritual children. And for people out there that don't have children, that they would desire to minister and to love their spiritual children that you would give them. I pray for our small group ministries, for the love of family and mutual discipleship that occurs, the application of the word. I pray that you would help us to just continue to make truth relational and that you would continue to let truth ever ring from the front in this church. I pray for the life of the person that knows that they've made a mess of their life and they know that the truth deep down is that they're going to continue making a mess of it until they let you redeem it. And if there's anybody here today that is thinking that, I pray that you would let them pull me or JT or Cornelius or Denny or Matt or David. There's tons of people here they could talk to about that. We would love to do so. Give them the courage to be real with that fact, with where they are at and how much they need you. We love you. We thank you. We praise you. Pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.